7. The Southern Gaming Federation, a division of the American Gaming Federation, was a trade group made up of casino operators, suppliers, and other entities with gaming interests. AGF had recently relocated its southern headquarters from Charleston, South Carolina, to Nashville, Tennessee. Founded in the late 1980s, the Federation championed the $240 billion industry, supervised and protected it, and supported the 2.7 million casino jobs in 48 states. Utah and Hawaii were gaming free. Utah made sense, but Hawaii? SGF promoted corporate and public responsibility, industry initiatives, and what my husband had more than a vested interest in, legislative and regulatory challenges faced by gaming. More than anything else, the Gaming Federation served as the industry's voice on Capitol Hill. Bradley, a casino attorney before he was a casino CEO, loved everything about it and never missed the annual symposium. I think he loved that it was his field, gaming, but without the gaming. No smoke, no liquor, no cash to protect, no bells, whistles, or angst. While it was easy and fun to watch a gambler bet $5 and win a million, it happened very rarely, whereas he saw the darker side of gambling every day. And it wasn't easy or fun to watch a player donate his or her life savings to a jumbo lap of luxury double deluxe bonus slot machine. Gamblers seldom left the casino as happy as they'd arrived. And while Bradley had justified the moral aspect of gaming long before the girls were born, the players knew what they were doing. He was increasingly concerned about how we'd introduce and explain the ethics of his chosen profession to them as they grew. We both were. My concerns weren't as gambling-centric as his were. It bothered me more that Bexley and Quinn would never play in their own backyard, because their backyard was a casino. Then it bothered me they'd know what double down on aces meant before kindergarten. All that to say this. The talk was coming. We were quietly preparing. We loved Biloxi. We loved the Bellissimo. We'd met and married there. The view of the Gulf from every window of our home couldn't be beat. But did we really want to raise our daughters there? If not, where? Realistically, attorneys could work anywhere. And if it ever came to it, law enforcement, which was to say me, could too. But what would that look like? East Texas, where he was from and where his mother lived? No. Pineapple, Alabama, my home? No. No. Lately, it looked a lot like Nashville. Bradley was thrilled when SGF moved its headquarters. It would be, if we were to pursue it, a smooth move from casino CEO to SGF administrator, and as such, he'd been dropping Nashville nuggets on me for weeks.
Davis, did you know the driveway at Andrew Jackson's home in Nashville was shaped like a guitar decades before Nashville was known for country music?
I didn't.
Davis, listen to this. Nashville has a full-sized replica of the Parthenon in Centennial Park.
Really?
An hour later. Davis, Seabiscuit was from Nashville.
The horse? I asked.
The horse.
In the weeks leading up to the symposium, Bradley's fascination with Nashville whittled down to one primary, three major, and three minor points of interest. Primary, it would be a great place for us to raise our daughters. Major, the Southern Gaming Federation, Harpeth Hall School and Vanderbilt University. Minor, Brentwood, the suburb of, the Tennessee Titans, and the Nashville Predators. While some had a one-year plan and others a five-year plan, Bradley operated on a 10-year plan until we became parents. Then he began projecting further. Now he planned 20 years into the future, all the way to our daughters graduating from Vanderbilt Law School. He had yet to speak the words.
We should think about Nashville.
But I could hear them nonetheless. The day before Meredith didn't arrive, he'd said again he wished the girls and I could go with him, and asked me if I knew the closest casino to Nashville was almost 200 miles away. I did not. I did know the draw of Nashville and thoughts of our family's future were on his conference agenda, and I didn't want to, nor did I want him to, change his plans. The next morning, it took everything I had to kiss him bye. But not only did he want to go, for professional and personal reasons, I wouldn't and couldn't make him part of what I was about to do. I only had one interest in Nashville. A son for us, a brother for Bex and Quinn, because that was a decision already carved in stone. No more casino babies. Two was enough. The first thing I did on the second morning of my sister's captivity was see my husband off. As hard as it was to keep a straight face when I told him all was well, I had this. What I really had was a feeling that letting him go wouldn't be the hardest part of my day. Next, I sent out an SOS to the girl's nanny, July Jackson, to tell her I needed her ASAP. I'll be there in 10. She could get to me in 10 because, like us, July lived at the Bellissimo, in a condo on the 25th floor. She helped me with Bex and Quinn 4 days a week, Monday through Thursday from 10 until 2. For the most part, she came to us because we lived in 10,000 square feet, and that meant endless hide and seek. But with all that had happened and all that might, I thought it best for the girls to be off-site. So I asked July to take them downstairs to her Bellissimo home, which, for the girls, was like going to Disney. Is everything okay, Davis? July, so cute, so smart, and part of our family in many ways, was sharp, too. I chose my words carefully. I think so. You think so? Bex and Quinn were all over her, tugging and pulling her to the elevator. Mommy who? I do. I did not. I couldn't even hint at my predicament, and a Sunday predicament at that, which never happened. Thus, July's suspicion all wasn't well. Sunday was Baylor's one day off. Baylor, as in Bellissimo Spy Team Baylor, took up all the slack Fantasy and I left when we semi-retired to spend more time with our families. Baylor was the other half of July, and why she lived at the Bellissimo. Because he did. When Baylor wasn't working and July wasn't with my girls, they were glued together. July's New Orleans parents thought she lived with us. She was 28, he was 29. A secret I didn't think we'd have to keep much longer. I saw a ring in July's future. And I saw trouble from Baylor in my future if I even hinted at the trouble I was in. To let on to July would be to let on to Baylor. Everyone in our world had finely tuned radars. Everything's fine, I lied. It would be. It had to be. I don't know how long I'll need you today. It could be several hours. You know where we'll be if you need us. And there went my girls. I braced myself for my third chore. Vree. I found her in my living room, perched on the edge of a deep swivel chair, staring out the glass wall at the city of Biloxi. She was spilling out of a sleeveless floral top over denim capris. Her long blonde hair was pulled back in a tight ponytail. Her posture was ramrod straight, her hands balled into fists on her thighs, and she smelled like apple pie. I sat directly in her sights. "Davis!" She said my name on a relieved sigh, so happy to have someone to talk to. At. Vree. "Did you sleep?" "I didn't. I was awake most of the night. I mean, I'm so used to Gooch snoring. He's like an engine running, you know, white noise, the kind that keeps you asleep. I called him twice to ask him to put his phone on speaker and then lay it on my side of the bed. Then I was going to put mine on speaker and lay it on his side of the bed. You know what I mean? The side of the bed that would be his if he was here. And thank goodness he's not. I called twice and he didn't answer either time. I got his voicemail and it said, Vreeland is out of town. Don't be bothering me. Which I didn't appreciate one little bit, especially since I couldn't sleep. But I thought, well, maybe it's a good thing because I'd probably end up telling him what his witchy aunt was up to and we're not supposed to tell or else. So I didn't get 10 winks. You know those sound machines that have crickets chirping and ocean waves? They should add another song. Gooch snoring. I couldn't sleep because it was too quiet and I couldn't sleep for worrying about Bubbles and Meredith and you. I was worried about you. I mean, this has got to be killing you, Davis. I feel like I know what Bubbles is doing because I'm channeling her with my brain, and I think she's either curled up on Mare's lap or she's found a hidey hole somewhere in the camper, like a tucked away comfy place, and she's dreaming puppy dreams. As smart as Bubbles is, she still doesn't really know what's going on. I mean, she knows she's not with her mommy, but she doesn't know, you know. I was awake wondering what Bubbly was doing, wondering if you were awake, wondering what Meredith was doing. And Meredith isn't a Westie. She's a person, my bestie best person. This is awful. This is the worst. This is a nightmare.
Vree got in a full workout with her good morning Davis speech. I could have been wearing noise-blocking earmuffs and still picked up the gist of it because she'd acted out every thought. Every time she'd said the word sleep, she'd feigned nodding off. Ocean was accompanied with hula girl waves. When she'd said gooch, she'd made burly arms and took on a split-second caveman persona. When she was channeling bubblegum with her brain, she rolled her eyes back in her head and pressed fingertips to her forehead. It was draining, and Vree's way of coping the nonstop noise and action. She stayed so busy narrating her life, she almost didn't give herself time to live it. She certainly didn't give herself time to think. I wondered again what it was she didn't want to think about. Vree, is Meredith sick? Her arm shot out, her eyes darted right and left. Then she said,
"Wait just a minute, what?"
"Is Meredith sick? Has she said anything? Have you noticed anything? Has she complained about anything? Headaches? Weight loss? Do her pinky fingers hurt?"
"Davis."
Vree glanced at the slim gold watch on her wrist.
"It's so early. I mean, really, truly, shouldn't we be talking about going to Houston or robbing the casino or not killing Bootsy or finding a dog for me to show so I can win the money? All the things we talked about yesterday, all the halfway plans we made to get them back. Shouldn't we be talking about the other half of those plans? Why are you asking me about Meredith's pinky fingers?"
I didn't answer. I sat there, patiently. I decided to take a different approach with Vree that day in my efforts to elicit information. Instead of stop-signing her, I'd wait her out. It didn't take long. About 2 seconds.
"Sick? Like the flu? We have flu shots," she said. "We didn't get them from that idiot Erlene. Do you know Dr. Erlene? Leverett Erlene? He took Dr. Kizzy's place at Pineapple a day when Kizzy retired. You know how everyone thought Kizzy was crazy. Wait till you meet Erlene. Have you met Erlene?" "Sure, you've met Erlene. So you know Erlene, and he's why we went to Greenville for our flu shots, because for all we knew, he might accidentally shoot us with straight-up Ebola. We had the salad bar at Ruby Tuesday after Ruby Tuesday has the only salad bar left in the world that has pickled red beets. I love pickled red beets. Meredith, not so much, but she's had her flu shot for sure. And it's like spring. No one has the flu in the spring. Well, wait, maybe some people have the flu in the spring. I mean, it's not like I'm the flu patrol. I do keep an ear to the ground, you know. I keep up, but that doesn't mean I understand the flu or flu shots for that matter, because then you can tell me if I'm wrong. Don't they make the shots from old flu? You can't get the old flu. You can only get the new flu. So what good does a shot of old flu do? I said quietly. No, Vree said. Meredith's not sick. She's not sick at all.
There had to be more.
We had blood work done.
More. Who had blood work done, Vree?
Everyone. Everyone in Pineapple, even people from Yellow Bluff and Oak Hill, and we did go to Dingbat Erlene's office to get stuck for blood when we didn't go for flu shots because it wasn't Erlene doing the shooting or the sticking, it was Jenna Ray. You remember Jenna Ray, Kizzy's old nurse? All we did was stop by Erlene's for Jenna Ray to draw our blood because Jenna Ray isn't off her rocker like Erlene is. I don't think she's really a nurse either, but you know Jenna Ray, she'll do in a pinch. She's put 200 stitches in Gooch at least and 2,000 in his brother's. She sets bones and pops backs, and she even delivered a breech calf. Did you hear about that? So we all think of Jenna Ray as a nurse, and you know, no one minded her taking their blood.
An odd energy buzzed behind my eyes. Vree? Why did everyone in town have blood drawn?
Gully's brother?
She said it so matter-of-factly, as if it had nothing to do with anything.
He's sick, Vree said. You know Gully's brother, Green, Jesus Water Green, who Boosie works for? He has a blood disease, long name. I couldn't come up with it if you paid me. He needs a blood donor, like I mean someone whose blood works with his. Preacher Gully's blood wasn't a match, even though they're brothers. Same mother, same father. Go figure. Bootsy was second in line because she's sweet on him. You knew that, right? Not Preacher Gully, but Brother Gully. But you knew that.
I did not know that. I most certainly did not.
Hers wasn't a match either, Vree said. I guess not, since she has witch blood. Her blood wouldn't match anything but another witch's blood, right? They're the oddest couple in the whole wide world, Bootsy and Green, especially since he's sick. He only has, like, half of the blood going to his brain that's supposed to be going there, so his eyes roll around because of his blood disease. His skin has this green glow like alien green, which, in a way, is funny. Like, green is green, you know? And then there's Bootsy in her witch clothes. They're scary looking together.
I forced breath into my body, then out.
Davis?
I stared out the window when I said, could you not have told me this yesterday when it was the very thing we were talking about?
Told you what? What were we talking about? Which time?
When I asked you repeatedly what the connection was between Bootsy and Gully, did you not think to mention they were a couple?
For one thing, Davis, you kept holding up stop signs, and for another thing, you asked me about Bootsy and Preacher Gully, Davis, not Brother Gully.
I stood.
Where are you going?
Give me a minute. I took a walk, cooled off. Pulled myself together. I poured us both a cup of coffee, and when I was sure I was past the point of throttling her, which wouldn't help a bit, I sat back down and passed her a cup. Let's start where we stopped, I said. Gully's brother is sick.
Yes.
She blew across the top of her coffee.
Sick, sick, bad.
Tell me about it, Vree. Her favorite words.
He's sick with a blood disease, and worse, he doesn't have insurance. I don't think they pay attention to details at Jesus Water. I hope they pay their taxes. Surely they pay taxes. I mean, it's Uncle Sam, you know? And you'd think Jesus would be watching out after them. I just thought of something, Davis. They must not be drinking the Jesus water. Otherwise, how could this happen? They're not drinking the water. You can't get the blessings out of the bottles if you don't drink them. Or maybe they are, and they think drinking Jesus water takes the place of paying taxes, which is ridiculous. I'd like to see them try to talk the IRS into that. Truth is, Davis, I don't know if they pay taxes or not, but I tell you one thing I know for sure they don't pay, and that's insurance. And how I know they don't is because Gully's brother doesn't have any, not a lick. So the first problem is finding someone who has Green's blood.
That was where I could hear my own blood rushing through my temples.
Or I should say a match for Green's blood. And then the next problem is how are they going to pay for it? Because it's like $1 million.
That was where I broke out in a sweat.
And if they ever find those two things, the blood and the money, then they have to find a hospital to do it. move the blood out of the match person and into green. It's supposedly as expensive as a bone marrow transplant, and I guess not many doctors do it. For sure, that crazy Erlene doesn't. That was where a cool tear I didn't know was coming slid down my hot cheek. So I think there are like 4 hospitals who can do what Gully's brother needs done. Maybe 14 or 40. None in Alabama, no doubt. It's a mess. I mean it. Gully's brother is in a bad way. My mind raced around my little sister's incredible heart. Vree scratched her neck. Finally, she asked, "What was the question?" It took me a beat to find my voice. "Why did everyone have blood drawn?" "Oh, I answered that. To find a match for Gully's brother. Next question." My mouth was so dry, my body on fire, my heart in my throat. I barely got it out. "Did they?"
"Did they what?"
"Find a match?"
"Yes."
I could see it coming. First, in her eyes.
"One."
Then her face.
"Meredith."
With my sister's name, every muscle in Vree's body walked off the job. I caught her as she tipped forward, out cold. I eased her to the floor. I collapsed beside her, knowing it was a very good thing I'd let my husband go to Nashville and that my girls were safe with July, because I truly might have to rob the casino. 8. 10 quiet minutes passed after Vree came to. We were side by side on the sofa, her sipping a Coke with one hand and holding a cold cloth to her forehead with the other, the two of us staring out the glass wall in silence, when the doorbell rang. My heavy heart and I didn't get up to see who it was. I didn't care unless it was Meredith, until my phone buzzed with a text. The caller ID said, "No hair," and the message was, "Let me in." No Hair's real name was Jeremy Covey, my boss and one of the first people I met when I came to work at the Bellissimo 5 years ago. He's the head of security, the size of a minivan, a true friend, and shiny bald. The doorbell rang again and again and again until another text landed on the screen of my phone. "If you don't let me in, I'll let myself in. I don't have all day." I dragged my feet through the living room, down the hall, and around the foyer to the front door. I opened it, and there stood No Hair, holding the bunched knot of 2 ends of a Bellissimo hotel bath towel fashioned into a sling. Protruding from the bath towel sling were the front and back ends of what might be the ugliest dog I'd ever seen in my life. It might not have been a dog. It might have been a weasel or an armadillo. It was an animal for sure, and if by any chance it had any dog DNA, it might have been Chihuahua. Maybe 10% Chihuahua, 40% polecat, 50% baby dragon. It wasn't big, maybe 10 or 12 pounds, had a severe underbite, inordinately long stick legs all dangling from the towel sling, one small black eye, and one large yellow eye. The yellow eye stuck out, as in protruded. Its ears were larger than its head, and set at odd angles from each other, with one where it was supposed to be on top of its head and the other misplaced, more on the side of its head. The animal was missing large patches of hair in some places, and others, like directly above the bulging yellow eye, sprouted thick white tufts. One back leg was completely bald and purple. Whatever it was, it had purple skin. That was just what I could see. There was more of it in the towel. I was 10 feet away, and I could smell it. I couldn't identify the smell right away because it was such an assault, it defied immediate recognition. I didn't know if I smelled garlic, swamp, or Doritos. Maybe all of the above. I pulled my shirt over my nose and mouth while No Hair held his towel sling package as far away from his body as he could, which was way too close. With a low, ominous growl deep in its throat, the dog trained the yellow eye on me. Then all its legs got going in the air as if it were trying to race my way. The dog wanted to eat me. No Hair, towel sling first, stepped into my home with it. I plastered myself against the wall. Then, with no warning whatsoever, the towel started dripping. The dog was leaking all over my travertine floor and No Hair's shoes. A vast amount of fluid, a fountain, at least a gallon. It went on and on. That whole time the dog, head tipped back, eyes closed, audibly sighed, as in, ah. I was too stunned to speak, move, and I certainly didn't dare breathe. No Hair looked at the ceiling and shook his head. The dog finished its business from several feet off the ground. No Hair said,
"This, Davis, is Princess."
"So? Get it out! Look what it did to my floor!"
"Your floor? How about my shoes? These are Ferragamos, Davis, and I just broke them in."
The dog tipped its head back, which was to say, its inordinately large ears disappeared for a second, and I swear to you, it laughed. Its tongue was black, which was when, to my horror, I remembered. I was expecting a princess. I'd made the Bellissimo pet-friendly, and a pet named Princess was checking in today. This couldn't possibly be her. Yet here we were, me, No Hair, and a creature named Princess. "Vree," I yelled over my shoulder, "get in here." No Hair was swinging the princess sling like a pendulum at me.
"Take it."
I was slowly creeping away, willing to creep through my house, out a window, over the safety ledge, and down 29 stories in a free fall because I didn't want it. I crept all the way into Vree, who took one look at No Hair and the creature in the towel sling, then said,
"What in the world?"
I didn't know if she was talking about No Hair, who made an intimidating first impression because he size XXXL, or the dog, or the lake on my travertine floor. Probably the dog, if it even was a dog. It had raccoon paws, as in opposable thumbs.
"Take this dog, Davis,"
No Hair said.
"Do something with it, or I'll march it straight to your room and land it in the middle of your bed."
The towel was still dripping. Vree tried to help. She took a brave step forward and, in a sing-song voice, said,
"Hey there, good little thing."
She eased a hand in the dog's direction, and the dog spit on her. From several feet away, it reared its head back, hissed, and spit on her. Vree jerked back and we huddled, then started a slow retreating dance around my circular foyer. No Hair took one step forward with the dog for every two steps we took back. We were doing our best to put space between us and them. I wasn't about to take it from him, which would mean holding it. I couldn't believe No Hair was still holding it. He was going to need to burn his clothes, then boil himself. I stopped with an idea. "The playpen."
"Who?"
Vree asked, her head snapping back and forth. I made a run for the storage closet, Vree on my heels. I had two pop-and-play playpens from when Bex and Quinn were infants. I had two of everything from when Bex and Quinn were infants. I tore open the door, then tossed while re-dodged a double infant stroller, two bouncers, two activity centers, 10 baby gates, and a double baby swing before I unearthed the collapsed pop and play. From the foyer, we heard something that sounded like a cross between a fire drill and fingernails on a chalkboard. It got louder and louder. We left the baby yard sale contents scattered up and down the hall, then lumbered back to the foyer with a compact length of the pop-and-play between us, the noise from the foyer growing more urgent. Over it, Vree yelled,
"That's not barking!"
"No hair!" We dropped the pop-and-play on the travertine floor. "What did you do to it?"
"I didn't do a thing to it,"
he said over the noise.
"And I'm not holding it one more minute."
The animal's head was tipped back, mouth wide open, and the noise kept coming. "Hang on." A whiff of garlic Doritos wafted my way. My eyes watered and I couldn't remember who I was, what I was doing, what my sister's name was, or how to make the pop and play pop. I turned my head the other way, gulped what clean air I could, then tackled the playpen. The second I wrestled it open, No Hair suspended the towel sling over it, then let the animal slide out. I secured the safety latches, then the three of us watched it turn circles from a safe distance. It was missing a huge chunk of fur from the middle of its back. No Hair pulled reading glasses from inside his jacket and perched them on his nose. From a different pocket, he produced a piece of paper.
"This is an email from the front desk, Davis."
He shook it open and cleared his throat.
"Mr. Covey, I'm not sure what to do with this animal. The couple checking in left it with me, claiming they had a reservation for it. I realize we have the pet show this week, and guests are checking in with pets right and left, but these guests, whose pet isn't in the show, insisted it had its own reservation. When I tried to explain our no-pet policy, the woman climbed over the front desk, backed me into the corner, took my picture, posted it on Facebook, and threatened me. At which point, obviously, I said we'd take the dog. I think it's upset or maybe has issues or, honestly, it could be the owners. They were unusual, to say the very least. They said the dog's name was Princess, and she's a 6-year-old Mexican hairless chihuahua. I asked if she was up to date on her shots, and they said yes, including a double dose for rabies. They said the dog only eats manicotti with extra sauce and thumbprint cookies. It doesn't like to be touched, and they told me not to laugh, sing, or wear bracelets around it. They said it loves to watch YouTube videos of Madeleine Albright's speeches, especially Madeleine's TED Talk. They said, play it over and over. They claim she's sweet once you get to know her, but then said it was terrified of hangers, as in clothes hangers, and men with beards. They said they'd pick her up Friday morning and walked off. Actually, they ran. It was very disturbing and very confusing. I thought about calling animal control but decided to check their reservation first. Mr. Covey, they really do have a reservation for their animal. I had the IT department look it up, and they confirmed the reservation originated from an IP address on the 29th floor. Since that could only be Mr. Cole, and he's out of town, I thought I'd contact you. Can you help me?
Of all the bad news and the email from the front desk, the worst was the Friday morning part. Friday morning? It was Sunday. I'd signed up to keep it for the next 5 days.
Do you have anything to say for yourself, Davis?
No Hair asked. I shook my head. I did not. He shoved the note at us, then spun on his contaminated Ferragamo heels and left. From the open door, a red satin duffel bag slid in and came to a stop between the pop and play and the puddle. Princess yelped at it. My front door slammed. Hard. Vree and I looked at each other. Princess sat down and began gnawing on herself, the purple leg, furiously. "Get that in, Vree.
Why?
Because it's not staying in my foyer. We picked up the playpen. Princess gave her purple leg a break long enough to hiss at us, and then went right back to it.
Davis, this thing is leaking.
All over my hall.
Where are we taking her?
This way. I led the charge to the guest wing as far away as possible from where my children would be when they returned. We lumbered down the hall to the smallest of the three guest rooms, the one with twin beds, a rocking chair, and a perfect view of the gulf. I opened the drapes, and we pushed the pop-and-play against the window. Next, I called housekeeping and told them I'd had a little nuclear waste spill. Would they please send a cleanup crew with everything they had? And the cleanup crew should probably wear hazmat suits. Bring heavy equipment and plenty of straight bleach.
There are 20 boxes of Stouffer's cheese manicotti and 2 huge jars of Ragu thick and hearty roasted garlic sauce in here.
Vree was going through Princess's luggage, and that explained the garlic smell.
There's a muzzle, Davis, and pumpkin-scented dog perfume and million dog toys, and what are these?
She held up long Kevlar gloves. Safety gloves, Vree. Those are safety gloves.
Why?
Vree's eyes were wide. It was 10 o'clock in the morning. I had things to do, save my sister things. And I'd have liked to have saved her by 7 tonight when I would take my seat at the judges' table in the conference center for the first round of competition at the dog show, none of which would happen if I choked to death.
Vree, stop!
Vree was blasting Princess with the pumpkin juice. I batted through the haze.
I was just trying to help Davis. She doesn't smell good.
And now she smells worse. Now the dog, dripping pumpkin perfume all over the pop-and-play, was mad. It charged us, teeth bared, bouncing off the mesh sides of the playpen every time, which made it even madder. Do something, Vree.
What?
She dove into Princess's duffel bag and came back with a tattered blanket. The minute she held it up, Princess quieted to a whimper and the room filled with a different noxious gas.
This must be her blankie.
Vree had it pinched between 2 fingernails. Princess saw it, or maybe got a whiff of it, and was trying to vault out of the playpen.
Throw it in there, Vree!
Princess, clearly happy to see the blanket, bunched it up, circled it, then fell on it.
There's one problem,
Vree pointed. The dog's fur, soaked in pumpkin perfume, parted in wet clumps to reveal a rhinestone dog collar digging into its neck.
Her collar is too small. It's choking her.
Vree was right. The collar was way too tight. Take it off.
I'm not touching it,
Vree said. I rolled my eyes. I pulled on the Kevlar gloves. I dove into the playpen and freed the dog from the collar. I held it by a silver buckle for Vree to see and said, Vree, you're a big chicken. I tossed the Kevlar gloves and the ridiculous collar, then sat down on one of the twin beds. Where's the email?
What email?
The email from the front desk. We need the owners. We need their names. I'm going to call and tell them to come get their animal. There's no way we can put this dog in the dog show, and we can't keep it here. Vree batted around and produced the email. She studied it.
The only name is Lauren Clark.
That wouldn't help. Lauren was the front desk receptionist who sent the email. Let me have it. Vree was right. No guest name. No guest room number. I called the front desk to hear Lauren had gone home sick. I wasn't surprised because I was half sick myself. Had I linked the pet page to the guest page? Surely I had. If not, I was perfectly willing to page Princess's anonymous owners in the casino on a loop around the clock until they showed up.
Behind me, a grating noise erupted from the playpen. Aw, that's sweet. Vree had to raise her voice. It's sleeping, and it snores like Gooch. I braved a look. Princess was sleeping flat on her back with the yellow eye wide open. The yellow eye was still aimed at me. Can you sit with it, Vree? Vree's face immediately registered terror. Can you stay here with it long enough for me to go to my office? No. Vree, do you remember what happened right before it got here? No. Think about it. She paled. She remembered. She surveyed the room, locating the nearest exits. Go, she said. Do your computer thing, Davis. Find Meredith, find Bubbles, and please hurry. Hurry I did, away from the dog, listening for the doorbell with one ear. Housekeeping should have been there by then. I used my other ear to check in with my husband, who'd arrived in Nashville without incident.
Davis, it's beautiful. The mountains.
Then July, for a Bex and Quinn report. All was well. I sat down at my desk and fired up my system. I passed on several emails from Bianca Sanders and two from Fantasy, one with the subject line, Answer Your Phone. I'd get back with them later. After I saved my sister, I had work to do, and if I didn't have it done in the next little bit, I would be boarding a Bellissimo jet on my way to scour hospital parking lots in Houston, Texas. It took 12 minutes to find Green Gully and patient records at the third hospital I tried, Jackson Hospital in Montgomery, Alabama. It took 15 more minutes to crack Jackson's firewalls and get to Green's medical files. You'd think a hospital would have a more secure system. Green was listed as a plasmapheresis patient. The documentation went back 5 years. Every 3 months for 5 years, Green had checked into Jackson and been hooked up to a big machine that removed his blood from his body. The liquid was separated from the red and white cells. Then the red and white cells were returned to him minus the plasma, so he could produce more plasma. Plasma his body would reject. Plasma that would become so toxic to his circulatory system that within 3 months' time, he had to have the plasmapheresis procedure performed again. Green Gully had idiopathic thrombotic demyelinating polyneuropathy, a rare blood disorder that could be renamed, simply, bad plasma. The quarterly procedure required a 3-day hospital stay and cost upwards of $10,000, out of pocket, due at time of treatment, not covered even if Jesus Water had insurance. The only cure was to find a 1-in-a-million donor. Green Gully didn't need my sister's blood. He needed her plasma. His was no longer working. He needed someone else's. Meredith's. She was his 1-in-a-million. Meredith had to undergo the plasmapheresis procedure and give Gully her plasma to the tune of $1 million. I closed the excess of open blood screens on my computer, hoping to never see them again. I picked up the proof of life picture of Meredith and Bubblegum in the Winnebago I'd printed the night before, and it was a good thing it weighed a feather because I was too weak from all the vampire reading to hold anything heavier. I studied her face again, giving the window she could have escaped from 10 times only a glance because I realized, at some point along the way, Meredith made the decision to go through with it. If she hadn't, she wouldn't still be there. And if my sister had enough compassion for a man we barely knew to let the blood be drained from her body, I had to find enough compassion to pay for it. With the one caveat,
I didn't have $1 million.
Abbas, okay, E.
The noise that made my broken heart stop was coming from the doorway of my office and barely recognizable as human speech. No part of me wanted to ook, because clearly something was very wrong.
Abbas, okay, E.
I cut my eyes left and started at the floor. As I feared, it was fantasy. The feet in the doorway of my office were fantasies. I knew the canvas espadrilles.
Abbas!
I made it to her knees, skinny white jeans, still fantasy, and I think she was saying my name, a version of it anyway.
Is oo pon boke?
As my eyes hesitantly traveled up, the hem of her cropped pink, lightweight cashmere sweater came into view, the one with the V-neck and three-quarter sleeves. I made it that far, and she might have been asking me if my phone was broken. I couldn't help it. I slapped my hand over my eyes. I didn't want to see above her sweater. Maybe she'd just come from an emergency trip to the dentist and things hadn't gone as planned. Maybe she was chewing rocks. Maybe she bit her tongue off. But if it was anything else, I just didn't want to know.
Abbas, look at ye.
I peeked between my fingers. All I could see were lips. 9. Bexley and Quinn had Crayola double doodle boards. Scribbling ruled, but they were getting better at horizontal lines and lopsided circles. They always wanted me to guess what they'd drawn, and I guessed until I got it right. Mostly, they drew Daddy. When they wanted to mix it up, they'd draw moons or spiders or their best girl, July. At their stage of budding artistry, everything looked the same. The lines and loops, but I snapped pictures of each and every masterpiece anyway. I led Fantasy to my kitchen table, sat her down, then from the toy drawer, I pulled out a double doodle board and three My First crayons. Red, blue, and black. Everyone loved options. Do you not have a pen and paper? She'd chosen the red crayon, a subliminal message. Red was for rage. I wasn't about to add fuel to that fire. I stepped back into my office, emptied the paper tray of my printer, and grabbed a pen. Fantasy? I could finally look at her without shrieking. What happened? Talk about scribbling. She went at it. I didn't think she'd ever stop writing. When she finished, she shoved it at me. I don't know what happened. I woke up like this. My 50-pound lips woke me up. Do not ask me if this is collagen. It hadn't occurred to me. Not a bad guess, but it hadn't crossed my mind. And if it had, I wouldn't have asked. I want that woman out. She's still in my bonus room, and I'm not going anywhere near her. I want her gone, right now, this minute. Look at my lips. I woke up with these on my face. Every light in the house is flickering on and off. I poured myself coffee and my favorite cup exploded in my hands. Not that a drop of it would have made it past my lips if my cup hadn't blown up. I just wanted to hold it and smell it. Then my car wouldn't start. I can't talk. I barely have electricity. My favorite coffee cup spontaneously detonated. Then my car wouldn't start. Yesterday the fire, last night the birds. Now look at me. And this all started the minute I left here with that woman. What is wrong with her? I want her off my property. Now. And your ceiling is leaking in the foyer. Something fell. What is going on? Start talking. Start talking was underlined three times. She watched me read. When she knew I'd finished, she spilled out a string of angry, unrecognizable gibberish, poking the kitchen table for emphasis, slapping it once, and, while I didn't catch a single word, I got the gist of it. She wanted a full explanation. I pushed away from the table. I filled a Tommy Tippy insulated sippy cup with coffee, secured the lid, and put it down in front of her.
What is this?
Coffee. She made several unsuccessful attempts to get the coffee past her enormous lips before I suggested she tip her head back and shake the coffee into her open mouth. She said,
I ate you.
I patted her arm. No, you don't. I passed her a dish towel because coffee was dribbling down her cheeks, and I placed the proof of life picture of Meredith and bubblegum in front of her. Her head came down, coffee dripped on Meredith. Then Fantasy swung her lips my way.
Abbas?
Let me get Vree, I said. We'll try to explain. I turned the kitchen corner and from a mile away could hear Princess. Her fire drill bark. I picked up the pace. When I reached the guest room hall, I yelled, Vree? She didn't answer. Maybe she couldn't hear me over the dog yapping. Louder, I called her again. Vree, are you okay? Vree was not okay. Princess had tunneled out of the poppin' play and had Vree trapped in the closet. She'd scratched the paint off the closet door in long, thin streaks in her efforts to get to Vree and shoo her up. I quietly closed the door and ran. I wasn't abandoning Vree. If I'd distracted Princess to free Vree, the dog would have come after me and then been loose in the house. Closer to my own bedroom than anything else, I ducked in, ran around the bed, yanked open the drawer of my nightstand, and grabbed my laptop, praying it was charged. When I made it back to the guest room, Vree still in the closet, Princess having clawed down to the bare wood, I had YouTube pulled up on Google Chrome. My shaky fingers somehow found Madeleine Albright's TED Talk. I cranked up the volume, slid the laptop across the rug, and held my breath. Princess's top ear perked. She stopped screaming. Her paws slid down the closet door for the last time as she turned to find Madeleine. When she located the laptop in front of the destroyed poppin' play, she stretched out on her belly, crossed her front paws, and sighed. I counted to 10. Vree, you can come out now.
No!
I barely heard her. Seriously, Vree, come out. The closet door cracked. I could see one of Vree's eyes. It was wild. Finally, she worked up the nerve to put one toe out. She leapt on the twin bed closest to the door, then almost knocked me down, clearing the 6 feet from the foot of the bed to the hallway. We flattened ourselves on either side of the door. If you can just stay here long enough for me to get a baby gate, Vree, I'll be back in 2 seconds.
No,
she said.
You stay here and I'll get the baby gate.
Fine.
And I'm taking my time, Vree whispered. That dog is crazy.
She opened her mouth to explain and would probably, before she finished, throw in a few crockpot recipes and give me her thoughts on naval ships when my arm shot out and I pointed, as in, go. I would be guarding the dog alone, me versus it, for several minutes, so I prayed. I had 2 daughters to raise and a sister to save. I needed the dog to let me live long enough to get those 2 things done. There was nothing between me and it but a thin wall and an open door, and I didn't want to distract the dog by closing the door, just to distract her again when I opened it after Vree returned with a gate. And who knew how long that would take, because she had to go down the hall through the foyer to the other side of our house to get to the storage closet, where I hadn't found the time to return any baby equipment. Vree could very well find a wall to talk to at any point along the way. I cautiously poked my head in to check on Princess, and couldn't believe what I was seeing. Hearing, rather. The dog had Madeleine Albright's TED Talk memorized, which was not to say the dog was talking, but she was nose-to-lap screen-imitating Madeleine Albright's words, tone, inflection, modulation, and delivery. In dog language, yips and yaps, Princess was vocalizing along with the speech. What in the world? I observed until Vree returned, lugging a baby gate. I stopped her with a hand motion, then pointed at Princess and the laptop, then to my own ear, as in, listen. Vree cocked an ear, shrugged, then made, what, hands. I made binocular hands over my eyes, as in, look. Vree whispered,
do you want me to look or listen?
Both. She peeked.
Oh my gosh.
She clapped her hands to her face.
What is she doing?
She whispered.
What is she watching?
Madeline Albright's TED Talk. Vree's mouth dropped open. I could see her molars. I lapped the baby gate, effectively trapping Princess, but still able to hear or check on her without having to set foot in the bedroom, then led Vree to the kitchen. I said, don't overreact when you see fantasy. Pretend like nothing's wrong. We stepped into the kitchen. Vree took one look at fantasy and screamed bloody murder. Soon to be matched by the scream that escaped fantasy when she met Princess. And still, no housekeeping. No sister, no $1 million, and no housekeeping. The first poppin' play was wrecked. We set up the second one in the living room just off the kitchen. Fantasy kept making suggestions I couldn't understand. In a huff, she grabbed my laptop and recorded the TED Talk, then set it up to run on a loop. When the recording stopped 14 minutes and 59 seconds in, it started again. Princess patiently waited out the Ancestry and Cialis commercials. Fantasy, Vree, and I returned to the kitchen table, where I was gearing up to tell all. But just then the doorbell rang. Finally, two big burly housekeepers greeted me with blank stares. One had a thick beard that hit him mid-chest, and the other was wearing a green-eyed skull and crossbones nose ring. Past the facial hair and the piercing, they had enough industrial scrubbing equipment to clean up a crime scene. They were armed with everything. I think I saw a jackhammer. I know I saw a multi-purpose floor cleaner the size of a riding lawnmower. Maybe I shouldn't have used the words nuclear waste spill when I called it in. I pointed at the puddle. Then I pointed down my guest room hall. They circled, examined, and peered down the hall. I'll be through there if you need me. I pointed again. 30 minutes later, the nose-ringed housekeeper poked his head in my kitchen door and said,
you're good to go, Mrs. Cole. You got anything else? We're scheduled here for 2 hours.
I opened my mouth to say, no, thank you. Take your lawnmowers and hit the road. When a piece of paper landed in front of me. Send them to my house to get the witch. I wrote her back. We don't know these men. She wrote back. They're Bellissimo employees, and they're only going to the garage. It'll be fine. Have them jump my car off while they're there. While they didn't look like 90% of the housekeeping staff, the ones in starched uniforms who pushed cleaning carts in and out of guest rooms, they did look like they could handle Bootsy Howard. Not only did I need to get Bootsy out of the bonus room, I needed her for bartering purposes, too, and her phone wouldn't stop buzzing with texts from Gully. Sister Bootsy, has the Lord moved in mysterious ways yet? Sister Bootsy, have God's blessings from the casino rained down on us yet? Sister Bootsy, has the righteous hand of God struck Davis Way about the head yet? I paid the housekeeper's cash, retrieved from my cash stash cookie jar, $200 each, then called transportation to tell them I was sending two men to pick up a sturdy vehicle. I asked them to throw in jumper cables. Then I gave the housekeepers Bootsy repo instructions and directions to Fantasy's house. Fantasy said,
Unk oo,
to the nose-ringed housekeeper. I said, be careful, she bites.
Bring her back here?
Yes. No. I saw them out, then it was back to the kitchen where Vree and I told fantasy everything. The first time Vree got sidetracked,